The procession disappeared without a word. Soon the lecturer could be heard in the next chapel describing the life of St. Francis.
"George, I do believe that clergyman is the Brixton curate."
George went into the next chapel and returned, saying, "Perhaps he is. I don't remember."
"Then I'd better speak to him and remind him who I am. Is that Mr. Eager? Why did he go? How vexatious. I shall go and say we're sorry. Then perhaps he will come back."
"He will not come back," said George. But Mr. Emerson, contrite and unhappy, hurried away to apologize to the Reverend Cuthbert Eager. Lucy, apparently absorbed in a lunette, could hear the lecture again interrupted, the anxious, aggressive voice of the old man, the curt, injured replies of his opponent. The son was listening also.
"My father has that effect on nearly everyone," he informed her. "He will try to be kind."
"I hope we all try," said she, smiling nervously.
"Because we think it improves our characters. But he is kind to people because he loves them, and they find him out and are offended or frightened."
"How silly of them," said Lucy, though in her heart she sympathized. She watched the singular creature pace up and down the chapel. For a young man, his face was rugged, and, until the shadows fell upon it, hard. And shadowed, it sprang into tenderness. Mr. Emerson returned.
"Were you snubbed?" asked his son tranquilly.
"But we've spoilt the pleasure of I don't know how many people. They won't come back. Don't let us spoil yours," he continued to Lucy. "Have you looked at those saints?"
"Yes," said Lucy. "They're lovely. Do you know which is the tombstone that is praised in Ruskin?" He did not know, and suggested that they should try to guess it. George, rather to her relief, refused to move, and she and the old man wandered not unpleasantly about Santa Croce. But Mr. Emerson was only half interested. He watched the lecturer, whose success he believed he had impaired, and then he anxiously watched his son.
"Why will he look at that fresco?"
he said uneasily.
"I saw nothing in it."
"I like Giotto," she replied. "Though I like things like the Della Robbia babies better."
"So you ought. A baby is worth a dozen saints. And my baby's worth the whole of paradise. As far as I can see, he lives in hell."
Lucy again felt that this did not do.
"In hell," he repeated. "He's unhappy."
"Oh dear," said Lucy.
"How can he be unhappy when he's strong and alive? What more is one to give him? And think how he's been brought up, free from all the superstition and ignorance that lead men to hate one another in the name of God. With such an education as that, I thought he was bound to grow up happy."
She was no theologian, but she felt that here was a very foolish old man, as well as a very irreligious one.
"What are we to do with him?" he asked. "He comes out for his holiday to Italy and behaves like the little child who ought to have been playing and who hurt himself upon the tombstone. Eh? What did you say?"
Lucy had made no suggestion. Suddenly he said,
"Now don't be stupid over this. I don't require you to fall in love with my boy, but I do think you might try and understand him. You're nearer his age, and if you let yourself go, I'm sure you're sensible. You might help me pull out from the depths those thoughts that you do not understand and spread them out in the sunlight and know the meaning of them. By understanding George, you may learn to understand yourself. It will be good for both of you."
To this extraordinary speech, Lucy found no answer.
"I only know what it is that's wrong with him, not why it is."
"And what is it?" asked Lucy fearfully.
"The old trouble. Things won't fit."
"What things?"
"The things of the universe. It is quite true, they don't."
"Oh, Mr. Emerson, whatever do you mean?"
George and I both know that we come from the winds, and that we shall return to them, that all life is perhaps a knot, a tangle, a blemish in the eternal smoothness. But why should this make us unhappy? Let us rather love one another and work and rejoice. I don't believe in this world's sorrow."
Miss Honeychurch assented.
"Then make my boy think like us. Make him realize that by the side of the everlasting why, there is a yes. A transitory yes, if you like, but a yes."
Suddenly she laughed. A young man, melancholy because the universe wouldn't fit, because life was a tangle, or a wind, or a yes, or something? "I'm very sorry," she cried. "You'll think me unfeeling, but... Then she became matronly. "Oh, but your son wants employment. Why, I myself have worries, but I can generally forget them at the piano. And collecting stamps did no end of good for my brother."